The headlines: Lebanese media say an Iranian tanker carrying fuel for Lebanon has entered Syrian waters. Two more tankers are preparing to depart to help ease the country's fuel shortages. Israeli forces fire rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse Palestinian protesters in the Gaza Strip. We'll need several of them. And the Taliban are preparing to unveil their new government more than 2 weeks after the takeover of Afghanistan that brought an end to the 20 years of U.S.-led war. Hello and welcome, everybody. An Iranian vessel carrying fuel for Lebanon has arrived in Syrian waters. According to Lebanese media, the vessel will unload its cargo at one of Syrian ports from where the fuel consignment will be transferred to Lebanon by tankers. The Hezbollah resistance movement will donate part of the fuel to government hospitals and similar institutions. Afterwards, a private company will be tasked with selling the fuel to private organizations and power-generating bodies. Two more fuel tankers are preparing to depart to Lebanon to help ease Lebanon's fuel shortages. Still, a fourth fuel vessel is likely to leave Iran in the near future. Lebanon is facing fuel shortages, which Hezbollah blames on U.S. sanctions. Well, to delve further into the issue in Lebanon, we're now joined by our correspondent Mariam Saleh, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also joining us from Beirut, we have political analyst Kenim Sharada. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mariam. Talk to us about, first of all, the overall situation right now in Lebanon. We believe that an Iranian vessel carrying fuel is approaching Lebanon at the moment. Talk to us about how that can change the situation as people there are grappling with fuel shortages.
Well, this is a very significant issue. It's not only significant to now fill the fuel shortage in Lebanon, it's also strategically critical, especially since we saw that after the declaration of Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah saying that there will be shipments of Iran, he said it would be a convoy, not just one single ship. We have several ships coming up. He already declared about three specifically that are ready to reach Lebanon. However, you still have, I think we will be seeing more ships. That in itself triggered a lot of U.S. movement into Lebanon. We have statements by the U.S. ambassador saying that they will be facilitating electricity through from Egyptian gas, through Jordan, through Syria even. They seem to even be willing to break the so-called Caesar Act in order to assist Lebanon in that. We heard also from a congressional delegation in Lebanon just yesterday saying that there is no need for Iranian shipments because the U.S. will get this, will be handling this issue, so on and so forth. They seem to have felt that this would be a very strategic change in Lebanon. Analysts themselves have stressed that this will be very significant. It will be even similar to a victory similar to the one we saw in 2006. This is a very significant issue. However, the timing is not very precise. We need to wait for an official statement from Hezbollah or an official statement from Hezbollah Secretary General directly himself saying how this shipment will be brought into Lebanon.
Karim Sharara, also joining us from the Lebanese capital. Mr. Sharara, talk to us about the situation right now in Lebanon. Let's talk about all of the delays in conjuring a government. The country so direly needed that to happen. Why was it delayed for so long?
Well, I think there are many reasons for that. There is internal reasons and there's external reasons. As for Saad al-Hariri, who stayed on for 9 months trying to form a government, I think it's largely because the Saudis were so contrary to him forming a government, because he's on bad terms with the Saudis, and just recently we've heard that they've started selling off his company, Saudi OJ's assets in Saudi Arabia. He's deeply in debt. Although he used to be worth a few billion dollars, now he's deeply in debt. He recently, a few years ago, he had to close off his the Future Movement's TV station, Future TV, and he's not on good terms with the Saudis. He tried to mediate with some actors in order to be able to arrive to a certain agreement with them, but unfortunately for him, that didn't happen. As for the new PM designate, Miqati, he isn't someone who the Saudis are mad with. He's someone who's willing to accommodate the Saudis to a large extent. He does business with the Saudis. He does business with others too. But I mean, the internal reasons have to do with the power sharing, and of course we're talking about we have parliamentary elections in 2022, only a few months away. But this isn't the main reason, in my opinion. The main reason is also external, or has to do with how Miqati can handle the incoming fuel shipments. First and foremost, this is the primary reason, because the fuel-laden ships are incoming, and Miqati has to take a stand as far as the Americans are concerned, and he's not willing to be in power when he has to make that stand. So I think he's trying to buy some time in order for the few ships to come, and in order for them to be a fait accompli as far as the Americans are concerned. And so he would have gotten a huge load off his back. So now we're talking, as the fuel ships are coming, we're now hearing word of a possible formation of a government in the weekend or the week after. Of course, this is only speculation so far, but we are finally hearing some good news as the Americans are taking a step back because they misjudged Hezbollah's or the resistance's response to the brutal pressure the Americans are subjecting Lebanon to. They misjudged their step, how far they can pressure Lebanon, and now they have to concede. They're losing. They're fighting a losing battle. So they're trying to do whatever they can do in order to alleviate the situation as far as they're concerned, in order for it not to be a complete loss for them.
Mr. Sharon, I'm going to stay with you. Let's say that even if a cabinet is formed in Lebanon, that hurdle is finally passed. There's still a lot of work to do. What are the most urgent reforms that a future government must tackle in Lebanon?
I think the most immediate reforms have to do with the banking sector, because the banking sector has been the only winner of this whole debacle Lebanon is in. They have to remove the acting governor of the Bank of Lebanon, who's deeply in bed with the Americans and doing everything the Americans have asked of him. Of course, if they need to make actual reforms, they're going to need to choose someone who is not so much in bed with the Americans and willing to do reforms himself. Look, as far as Lebanon goes, as long as this current structure of power sharing is still in place, we're only buying time for Lebanon. If we want to do actual structural reforms, then Lebanon, as we know it, this current power sharing structure, this current structure that develops corruption, has to be completely removed. So as much as you, we can talk a lot about reforms in Lebanon, but there are reforms that have to do with the very structure Lebanon is built upon. You have the influence and the pressure foreign powers are exerting on Lebanon, particularly the Americans and the French. So putting that aside, I think the most significant reforms, so to speak, would be to take Lebanon out of the American, not the American equation, but the American power. So you need to take into account that you need to accommodate China's entry into the region. You need to accommodate the Russians. Lebanon has to play on balancing foreign powers in order to be able to make actual reforms. So yes, we do have internal problems, but external problems, foreign pressure are keeping Lebanon from making actual reforms. Those need to be dealt with before we can make domestic reforms.
Mariam, experts believe that the current socio-economic, financial, and political collapse could be the end of the current governing system in Lebanon. That's also a view Mr. Sharara shares as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it definitely needs to change. What you hear from the people, this is what you hear from even the political class themselves. However, this requires a lot of steps. We're talking about a change in the electoral law. We're talking about a change in how the system is run. But of course, the main issue that we're talking about is a sectarian system, which needs to be annulled. And that is an issue that is found even in the Constitution. However, with all these power sharing issues that we have in Lebanon, and even the current negotiations on the formation of the cabinet, prove that we are still deeply into that that system. How it will change, it's not clear. We've heard from Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah previously, a call for a national meeting, a national gathering for all the major sides to be able to reestablish the Lebanese state. That would be a very significant step for the Lebanese people, even, of course, if it does change in how we have representations in the parliament and which side, how, for example, a president is elected. All these issues, they need to be discussed. But in light of the polarization that we have in Lebanon, this could probably be a bit far-sighted or something that we might see, but on the long run.
Mr. Sharara, regionally, who benefits from uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
I think the answer for that is straightforward. If we're talking regionally, any instability in Lebanon, well, first of all, the primary beneficiary is Saudi Arabia, because ever since the civil war, the Saudis have been deeply connected with political parties in Lebanon and political instability in Lebanon. Saudi Arabia is the number one beneficiary from anything happening in Lebanon. So, for example, I mean, you can just look at the past few months. Who has been keeping the Lebanese government's formation? It's been the Saudis, and the Americans actually attested to this through their statements, the congressional delegation, that is, by saying that the Saudis should attempt to accommodate Mikati. It can't get any more clearer than this. You're talking all the way back to from the civil war up to the establishment of the Lebanese post civil war system to the banking sector, where the Saudis very much benefited from, to Lebanon, to the very fact that Lebanon was not given the chance to grow a cultural sector, or an agricultural sector, or a industrial sector. Lebanon was meant to be kept as a banking haven, as a touristic haven for many of these countries to come, so where they can alleviate the tensions of their people, where people will just come to take a breath of fresh air before they can continue with their lives. Lebanon was not given the chance to grow. Any chances of actual reform in Lebanon were prevented by anyone affiliated with the Saudis or the Americans for these many years.
All right, thanks a lot. We're going to leave it there. Political analyst Karim Sharara joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, thanks to Mariam Salah, also speaking to us from the Lebanese capital. Elsewhere, Israeli forces have violently attacked Palestinians protesting against the Israeli blockade for the fifth consecutive day near the buffer zone in the Gaza Strip. A number of protesters, including a young Gazan, were wounded after Israeli forces fired rubber-coated bullets and tear gas at them. Dozens of others also suffered breathing difficulties after inhaling tear gas. Two people have been killed, and dozens of others have been wounded since anti-Israel protests began over the weekend. Demonstrators say they will continue their protests until the regime lifts its blockade on the Strip. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has given us an update on the violent attack by Israeli forces against Palestinian demonstrators in the town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip.
We've seen this throughout the last week and last night in the east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah, young Palestinians were attacked by Israeli snipers who used live bullets, rubber-coated metal bullets, and also tear gas canisters, not only to fire tear gas towards the protesters to disperse them, but also to target them directly in the face and in the upper limbs, as they did in 2018, where at least 24 protesters in during the Great March of Return were killed by tear gas canisters, where Israeli soldiers would fire directly in the faces of children and medics and journalists during the those peaceful rallies. Palestinian youth are planning a mass rally tonight in the east of Gaza City to further exert pressure on the Israeli regime and in order to lift its hermetic and inhuman blockade against them that's been in place since 2007.
The Taliban are preparing to unveil a new government in Afghanistan after taking almost full control of the war-torn country. Taliban official Ahmadullah Motari said a ceremony is being prepared at the presidential palace in Kabul. Local news outlets have also said that an announcement on a new government is imminent. Taliban's top figures, including the group's supreme leader, Haybatullah Akhundzadeh, are in Afghanistan. The group sees the capital and the rest of the country in a matter of weeks. Last month, the U.S. also pulled out its remaining troops from there before the August 31st deadline, ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. The Taliban have showcased some of the American military hardware they captured during their takeover of Afghanistan. During the military parade, a long line of Humvees and other armored vehicles flying white and black Taliban flags drove a highway outside the city of Kandahar. The parade was held to celebrate the exit of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. The Taliban also flew an Afghan Army Black Hawk helicopter during celebrations. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Health tourism. In the name of God, salam, and welcome to the seventh episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you a leading hospital in Tehran, the Jam Hospital, and get more acquainted with the facilities of this hospital. Please stay tuned. Tehran, capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is a metropolis with a population of more than 8 million, the second most populous city in the West Asia region, and the 24th most populous city in the world. This metropolis is home to a wide range of tourist attractions and fun places to visit, including parks, palaces, old buildings, and many museums. Among the places well worth seeing in Tehran, we can mention Golestan Palace, Niavaran Museum Palace, the Sadabad Complex, Museum of Ancient Iran, Jamshidiya Park, Tochal Complex, and Bird Garden. In addition to hosting many tourists from all over the world every year, Tehran ranks first in Iran for health tourism and attracting foreign patients. The city of Tehran, as the capital of Iran and a modern city, has many welfare and hospital facilities and is home to some world-class experienced doctors and surgeons. This allows prospective health tourists to have a range of options for receiving medical treatment in this city. Many health tourists travel to Iran and seek medical treatment through facilitator companies. These companies, called mentors, help patients choose the best medical specialists and treatment centers based on their experience and knowledge. These companies offer various services such as obtaining visas and making travel arrangements, arranging hospital admission, and hiring interpreters and translators so that the treatment process can proceed more smoothly for health tourists. There are many facilitators in Iran, and especially in Tehran, where tourists can easily identify those that have obtained the required license from Iran's Ministry of Health and submit their applications by simply searching the internet. Dear listeners, we shall now learn more about Jam Hospital, one of the leading private hospitals in Tehran. Stay tuned, please. Jam Hospital is one of the oldest hospitals in Tehran, having been established in the early 1970s. This hospital has been set up along with the advancement of medical science and the development of Iranian universities through the cooperation of a group of famous Iranian physicians. Among these doctors, we can mention Professor Hassan Hashemian, Professor Ibrahim Sami, and Dr. Abdullah Ali Khani. The construction of the hospital started in 1968, and its construction and architecture were entrusted to a group of young Iranian engineers. In 1970, the hospital construction was completed with 9,000 square meters of infrastructure, and in 1974, Jam Hospital, which at that time was considered a well-equipped and modern hospital, began to operate. The hospital, at that time, had 128 beds and 3 advanced operating rooms and was equipped with radiology devices and cardiac equipment. In addition, Jam Hospital was the first private hospital in Tehran at that time to be equipped with a radioisotope facility. Since thyroid disease was very common in Iran at that time, the establishment of this hospital was a great help in treating this illness. Jam Hospital is located in the center of Tehran on Motahari Street, and the access roads are very convenient. This hospital has specialized wards, subspecialized surgery wards, subspecialized clinics, paraclinics, and administrative and logistics units. It also currently has 150 beds, as well as 27 beds in the CCU, ICU, and NICU. In addition, Jam Hospital has 6 active operating rooms ready to serve patients with modern equipment. In the operating rooms of Jam Hospital, thoracic open heart surgery, laparoscopy, neurology, orthopedics, and arthroscopy, obstetrics, general surgery, and cath lab, that is, angiography and angioplasty, are performed 24 hours a day. With the frequent and regular admission of foreign patients in Iran, Jam Hospital was able to obtain a license for its IPD department in the field of health tourism in 2016. The IPD ward of the hospital is a separate unit within the hospital with all medical staff being fluent in English. Patients are followed up in the hospital for several months after admission to ensure their complete treatment and recovery. In 2018, Jam Hospital provided services to about 700 hospitalized patients and 800 outpatients in the IPD department. Jam Hospital is one of the oldest and most well-known hospitals in Tehran. In 2016, it officially started its work of treating international patients and providing health tourism services by becoming the first hospital to gain the required licenses from the Deputy Minister of Health at the time. Jam Hospital is a specialty acute care hospital. Surgical operations that are usually performed at this hospital include heart surgeries, internal heart surgeries, specialized surgeries for treatment of various types of cancer, general orthopedic surgeries, obstetrics and gynecology, cosmetic surgeries, liver surgeries, endocrine diseases, dentistry, etc. Jam Hospital is one of the most well-equipped and up-to-date hospitals in terms of facilities it offers patients. CT scan radiology equipment, NMR scan, cardiac rehabilitation, and psychotherapy all can be offered to prospective Iranian and foreign patients. Foreign patients mostly go to Jam Hospital for treatment of heart disease, general surgeries, specialized surgeries, treatment of cancer, urological surgeries, chemotherapy, etc. Admission to the International Patient Department or IPD in Jam Hospital can be done in several ways. Patients can either refer to the website where they can search from their own country and receive required information, choose their doctors and the hospital, and so on. There are also facilitator companies that arrange hospital admission for international patients. Dear listeners, for direct communication with the Jam Hospital in Tehran, you can apply through the website of this hospital at http://jamhospital.ir or by calling 00981-841-4037 or 00981-841-4057. And get necessary information about the cost of treatment, methods of treatment, medical staff, etc. Jam Hospital is one of the most successful hospitals of its kind in Tehran. It has nearly half a century of experience, outstanding medical expertise, is equipped with the most advanced facilities in the world, offers quality medical services, and really cares for and respects its patients. This has been its recipe for success throughout these years. Dear listeners, that was the 7th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. The 20-year Afghanistan war has ended in what some have described as a humiliating defeat for the U.S. Even though the U.S. president may state otherwise, other leaders, like the Russian president, have said that the campaign ended in only tragedies and only losses. The Iranian president has said that the war spelled aggression and human rights violations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will review America's legacy after two decades of war, occupation, and conflict. Joining us for guests for this edition is activist, author, and a member of the Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism from Answer Coalition, Richard Becker. We also have international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda, who joins us from Moscow. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, Richard Becker, if I may. First, you have the speech by the U.S. President Joe Biden, in which he said it was an extraordinary success, the evacuation of the Kabul airport. Offered no apologies for either his decision to end the war or in the way that his administration actually executed that. And also, in some respects, though not 100%, he said that the war was a success. Why would he give that kind of impression on this war that many has have stated to be otherwise?
Well, I think that one thing that we've learned about our politicians is that they'll say anything that they think is in their own self-interest. You know, the latest phase of the U.S. war in Afghanistan began nearly 20 years ago. It could have ended in November of 2001 when the Taliban leadership basically offered to surrender if given, and their only condition was amnesty. But, you know, we've seen the arrogance, the hubris of imperial arrogance that has been manifested by every administration since then, from George W. Bush through Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and now Biden. All lies, lie after lie after lie, misrepresentation after misrepresentation. And meanwhile, we've seen enormous suffering on the part of the people of Afghanistan, of the soldiers who were sent to fight and die and kill from the United States and other countries, the loss of resources. Estimated now that it's estimated now by various sources that the war will end up costing between $4.965 trillion and $5.8 trillion dollars, and it may go much higher than that. That kind of money could have solved all the problems of the people of Afghanistan and much of the world, but it's gone. It's gone into the pockets of corrupt politicians, and it's gone up in smoke on the battlefield. And now where are we? We're right back at where we were in September of 2001 in terms of who is the government of Afghanistan. So to say in any respect, in any way, to try to claim that is a victory and that is success, I think just emphasizes what I started out saying, that the politicians will say anything.
Sure. Well, Mark Sloboda, you're there in Moscow. The Russian president has spoken on this occasion, and let me quote him when he said, for 20 years, American forces were present on this territory. For 20 years, they tried, as we can say without offense to anyone, to civilize the people who live there, to instill their own norms and standards of life in the widest possible sense of this word, including when it comes to the political organization of society. The result is only tragedies. Does he have a point?
Well, absolutely. And what the Russian president was saying was not altogether different from actually what Joe Biden was saying. Both, to some extent, were decrying the idea of invasive nation-building military operations. obviously, the Russian president was expressing it in much stronger terms. But those are exactly the same justifications that Joe Biden used for his withdrawal of military forces and his ending after two decades of the military conflict in Afghanistan. And I think my colleague was dead on the money when he spoke of hubris. And the Russian president is well aware of this because of the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, in the failure of a socialist nation building there. Now, at the time, there already was a socialist government that was under siege by U.S.-backed, armed, and salaried jihadists, mujahideen. But the situation is much the same at the end result, albeit, you know, the government that the Soviet Union left behind when they withdrew lasted for another 3 years and only eventually collapsed when the Soviet Union dissolved itself and was unable to continue financial aid there. But it's almost a trope, but it is also a truism that Afghanistan has been the graveyard of empires because of this hubristic idea of going in and changing the Afghan people, installing a foreign political, social, and value system. And the Russian president spoke of the need, for understanding the existing people's history, culture, and values. Despite Joe Biden decrying this nation building now, he supported it previously when he was a senator on the Foreign Relations Committee in the United States in the height of the Afghan war. The U.S. obviously still hasn't learned its lesson because it still has a military occupation force in Iraq against the express wishes of the Iraqi parliament. It is still has military occupation forces illegally in East Syria. It is still conducting a war on terror operations all across Africa and the Middle East. We can only hope that, Joe Biden reflects further on these continuing hubristic U.S. military operations in pursuit of global hegemony, as he has so tragically learned eventually from the events in Afghanistan.
Well, if we were to take a look at the whole situation in terms of the period of time that this took for it to happen, Richard Becker, when we say 20 years, there's a certain sense of what was translating on the ground, aside from any nation building that's supposed to have happened or any reconstruction, the fact that the military side of it should have proven to be successful in any regards. That is one of the biggest questions and the most repeated questions that is asked, at least based on the type of exposure that I've had, as to how can the U.S. that claims to have the biggest, the most effective, incredible army in the world not able to defeat the Taliban in the course of 20 years? What was going on there?
You know, it's a very interesting question, and it's a very important question. Matthew Hull, who has become an anti-war activist, but who was in the State Department, said a number of years ago, made this statement. He said, the more the U.S. troops take action inside Afghanistan, this isn't a direct quote, but I think it's close, the more resistance fighters there are. And we can understand that if we saw the way the war was really conducted, that, you know, there was a great deal of the same kind of thing that went on in Iraq, which is the night raids, where, you know, the patrol comes, it busts in the door of a family's house, it terrorizes the people in the house, and maybe it drags away one or more of the members of the household. They end up in a Bagram prison or another prison where they're tortured and abused. And they become, even if they weren't before, they become the active opponents enemies of the occupation forces. That's very understandable. I think everyone should think about what is it like to live under occupation, and what's the response of the people who are living under occupation. Do they like the occupiers? Well, maybe a few of them do, but the great majority of them resent the fact that their country is under foreign occupation and that they're treated the way that they're treated by the occupying troops. So that's the reality is that the form of the warfare created more and more and more resistance, and it wasn't only there, it was also in Iraq, it's also been in other countries. But this is the idea, and the idea to wage war in this way is it grows out of a fundamental form of racism, that we can do whatever we want, is the attitude of the occupiers. We can do whatever we want to these people because they're inferior to us, and we're superior to them, and we can crush them. And we've seen, you know, from the war in Vietnam to the wars in Iraq, and there's been two of those, that, you know, and the war in Afghanistan, that the reaction is the opposite of what the commanders and occupying forces expect. It's one that their repression, if it doesn't crush the people altogether, will result in greater and greater resistance. And I think that's what we've witnessed the victory of a resistance movement. I'm not a supporter of the Taliban. I think they're very reactionary policies and social policies in many respects. But they are an indigenous resistance movement, and that the fact that they were able to achieve victory is due to the fact that they are just that. They are of the people of Afghanistan.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Couple of interesting points, Mark Sloboda, that our guest, Richard Becker, makes. I want to find out from you whether this is indeed what has occurred. You know, this war on terror began back in 2001, officially with the invasion of Afghanistan. And then throughout that time, the U.S., of course, was engaged in other wars also. For example, lots of drone strikes that happened in Pakistan. But basically, the idea that the war on terror actually accelerated resistance fighters, which go against the U.S. That's on the one hand, and then when you take a look at the way that they actually were not successful, whether it's Iraq, Syria, you got Libya. On the other hand, you have Yemen, for example, in terms of their involvement there. How does that make the U.S. look in terms of the way that it's conducted the so-called war on terror?
Yeah. So, first of all, the United States does have the largest, best-funded, best-armed conventional military force in the world. And it's very, very good at taking on another state's armies and overthrowing governments. It's done that quite well in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It drove the Taliban out within a couple of weeks, almost as fast as the Taliban took back the country once the U.S. forces withdrew. But when they are tasked with this you know, the term is no nation building. You know, it's a form of colonialism. They don't understand the native cultures, and invariably they are viewed as an alien occupying force with foreign values. And American troops, you know, they don't understand the cultures, the language, and they do generate insurgency from the native population, often simply by their presence and their attempt to install a foreign political system and values. This becomes a self-perpetuating conflict, which is what, you know, the War on Terror very quickly morphed into. It became a war on tribal Islam in parts of the Islamic world where there was resistance to U.S. military occupation. And then, of course, we have the hypocrisy as well, because the so-called War on Terror, at the same time the U.S. was supporting Islamists and jihadists when it was to their interests, in Libya and Syria. And we're talking forces that are directly linked, allied with, embedded with, politically connected with al-Qaeda. I don't know how you explain that to the American people, except by not talking about it at all, not acknowledging the truth of that, because the American people, if they understood that, would of course recoil. I mean, from the forces, that they are told struck them on 9/11. We see this war on terror thus revealed not even so much as the war on tribal Islam, but a war for hegemony, a war for the pursuit of hegemony around the world, particularly in the Islamic world in North Africa, that was resisted in many areas. The best successes they had were by supporting jihadist forces in different areas. That contradiction, lies at the heart of U.S. foreign policy errors and blowback dating back to, the 1980s when the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen that would eventually morph into the Taliban and al-Qaeda themselves. So unless the U.S. learns these lessons, this hubris, this pursuit of hegemony, at whatever cost and, whatever allies they make or use along the way, then we're just unfortunately going to see this continue as the U.S. press is already talking up the shift to military confrontation with China on the other side of the Pacific, in the South China Sea, or in the Taiwan Straits. It seems that very little has been learned.
Well, I mean, how can that be the view of the U.S. when they have suffered the defeat that they have in Afghanistan, even if there are people, officials, or whomever in power that maybe doesn't believe so, and yet want to confront China militarily or threaten Iran, for example? I mean, how can the U.S. portray its strength when it suffered the way it did in Afghanistan, especially that it couldn't even execute a proper withdrawal from an airport?
Yes. Well, I think that what the U.S. is turning away from is the so-called nation building toward nation destroying. I think that the withdrawal of from the forces in Afghanistan, the wind down of the U.S., some of the, not completely, but some of the U.S. Engagement in the Middle East is meant to facilitate the concentration of forces against China in particular. But you can see that the U.S. policy right now against a number of countries is really aimed at destruction. And I'm talking about Cuba, the tightening of the blockade, which is causing great suffering inside Cuba in the midst of the pandemic, the sanctions being ratcheted up against Iran, against Venezuela, against Nicaragua, and of course, from a military point of view, day in, day out, if you follow any of the military websites, you see the preparation for war against China is going on. So this is a shift, and I think that the Biden administration is counting on the idea that this will be over with, that generally more people want the U.S. out of Afghanistan, a pretty strong majority, and that this will pass by. And meanwhile, the preparation for the most dangerous kind of war anyone can imagine is going forward at a very rapid pace. And this is, so the U.S. strategy, the objective, we are told, is that we must defeat China in the battle for the 21st century. But we should really think, the people of the United States and the people of China have no such interest in this, and I don't think the Chinese government wants to get in that kind of competition either. I know that they don't. But the U.S. government is propagandizing us to prepare us for a new war. Whether or not that war comes to pass or not, we certainly hope not. But this idea that we're in, you know, we the people should be thinking about our competition with China. We have no interest in a competition with China. We have an interest in friendship and solidarity and cooperation with other countries to face things like global pandemics and climate change and so forth. But instead, what the government of the United States is doing, and the Biden administration is really a kind of neocon administration, is trying to prepare us for the most terrible kind of war that any of us can imagine.
Mark Sloboda, I mean, come on, let's really be realistic. I mean, you talked about the U.S. and how it's going for this military confrontation. I mean, what could China be thinking based on the way that Afghanistan went down and the withdrawal that happened? And not only that, you had Kamala Harris, the VP, that was in that region, trying to muster up and rally nations in that region behind the U.S. That it kind of gets a stamp of approval to go after China, militarily perhaps. What are those nations thinking? When it's their backyard, and here the U.S. is moving full steam ahead. I mean, hasn't this Afghanistan debacle detracted, obviously, from the way that they see the U.S. being an effective force against China?
Well, first of all, the Chinese government, not that it had the same type of hegemonic pretensions that the U.S. did, will certainly take what happened to the United States in Afghanistan as a cautionary tale. And a reflection that over, you know, the last 20, 30 years, China has not engaged in that type of military interventions, you know, at great financial and human cost in the world. And when people try to, you know, refer to the coming conflict with China and the United States as an inevitable conflict along the lines of a Thucydides trap, a failing hegemon confronting inevitably a rising hegemon. You know, there's every indication that you know, a powerful China would be qualitatively different than the United States, that they would not suffer from this type of arrogant, imperial, militaristic hubris. U.S. allies that it is attempting to goad into this conflict, hopefully they also view this as a cautionary tale about how quickly they can be thrown to the side.
They are. They are.
The Kurds, whether in Iraq or Syria, would have learned this by now. They seem not to have. The forces that the U.S. supports in Kiev and the Ukraine are another indication of this. India, I mean, the U.S. is using this geopolitical term Indo-Pacific, which is, you know, the geopolitical translation of that is the U.S. attempting to dupe 1.4 billion Indians into serving as their cannon fodder in a war with China that India doesn't need.
Right.
Hopefully, they would learn something from this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's evidently, you know, history keeps making the same mistakes again and again.
Yeah, sorry to have jumped in because we're just almost out of time. Last question to you, Richard Becker, in under a minute. You have U.S. allies that are voicing concern, and maybe this time they're going to move ahead with their views, such as the European Union saying, you know, we can't rely on the U.S. Let's have our own army to go ahead with any type of foreign policy adventures that we might want to get into. Even the U.K. that had It's Defense Minister or Dominic Raab being questioned and grilled by Parliament, saying, you know, we shouldn't rely on U.S. intelligence all the time. So are we seeing U.S. allies realizing that, you know, the U.S. isn't always right in terms of the way it goes ahead militarily altogether? Under a minute, if you can.
Well, I think that the U.S. used the allies as really instruments in its global strategy of domination. And particularly in the Asian countries, Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, Philippines, Borneo, this buildup of forces and what the U.S. military leaders called the first island chain shows us exactly how they look at those countries, that they are military assets, that John Foster Dulles years ago called them unsinkable aircraft carriers. That's a horrific way to think about a country. And it's the way that the U.S. leaders look at these, at the other countries, as really pawns in their strategy of global domination.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Activist author and a member of the Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism from Answer Coalition, Richard Becker from San Francisco. And thank you, international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda from Moscow. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. Brought to you by Arab English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting Brother Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so very much for joining us, Sayyid. Assalamu alaikum, bro.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for introducing me. Habib Zata, yes, at your service.
Today, since we're recording this during the month of Muharram, I want to ask you guys about ignorance. I think is one of the main streaks of every human being, right? It's like one of our innate qualities. And no matter how much knowledge we acquire, we still possess a level of ignorance. And that happens to apply to almost every field of our lives, including in relation with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. One of the most obvious and apparent dimensions in which we express our blatant ignorance toward Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is how we mourn him. I'm not saying that our gatherings are ignorant. I'm saying we express a lot of ignorance in the method, in the manner of our mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. I feel that it could and should be more intellectual.
There's no doubt that when you look at people themselves, people are not equal. You have, you know, different levels of people. You have people are generally go to the majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam out of the sheer love for Imam Hussein. Some of them, they go because they want to get something more.